Hello, and welcome to this week's The Proteomics Show, a special limited series of The Proteomics Show sponsored by US HUPO.
Hi, I'm Ben Osborne, and I'm here with Mr. Holy City himself, Dr. Benjamin Neely. And this week, we changed gears a little, and we had a conversation with Katie Kopp, who is a graduate student at Vanderbilt, who's currently looking for postdoctoral positions in warm places in California.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, we got to commiserate a little bit about blood proteomics, but we, of course, got to go into weird places like learning about her guinea pig, Princess Leia, and her future plans, which I think are pretty exciting. So enjoy. Hello, and welcome to the Genomics Today podcast. We are here with Katie. Katie, thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. And so normally we would be asking you what you were talking about at US HUPO in Chicago, but today we're actually just kind of like, I don't know, tell us kind of what you do, or maybe what's the most exciting thing that you've got going on.
Yeah, so my dissertation work really is focusing on using plasma proteomics to answer questions about survival outcomes from sepsis. So primarily that's answering questions about racial disparities in sepsis. So I like to joke that I have put blood, sweat, and tears into this project, the patient's blood samples and my sweat and tears. But it's been really rewarding because we found some areas of overlap that, that are potential like universal changes in sepsis, but we've also uncovered some possible like race specific changes. And so it's been really cool to do this kind of work and really do something that hopefully is impactful.
Yeah. As a person that also does a lot of blood work, I feel like there should be some group of people that do blood proteomics and we have like a support group, because like it's surprisingly hard. Right. And I feel like when you meet someone else, you kind of commiserate like, oh, like what's your favorite hard thing about working with serum?
Hard thing.
I'll tell you mine. Here, mine is that like you never get good numbers, right? Everyone else is like, oh, I have 14,000 proteins. I'm like, I have 400, and like I'm really proud of it.
I would have to say mine is how dirty it makes the instrument and how quickly it makes the instrument dirty. Because it's kind of cool because then you get to take the instrument apart and clean it and like really see the guts of it. But then after a while, it just becomes annoying because you got to do that so often.
I'm sure Renee wants to hear things like that.
She encourages us to take it apart and really look at how everything works on the inside.
I love
how often is that? How often when you're really churning through samples, is it weekly or?
Not weekly. So I think we're in the habit of pretty much cleaning like the front end. So just those lenses, like probably like every other week or once a month. But we've found that the quadrupole gets dirty really fast too, way faster than our service contract permits PMs.
And is this an instrument that pumps down fast, or is this an Orbi trap where you're down for a day or two?
Yeah, they're all Orbi traps. So then you end up baking out.
Yeah. Now, how much of a hurdle do you think that's going to be for, we're all dreaming about clinical proteomics, and, like really getting this stuff into the clinic to help patients. How big of a setback is that going to be? Does it seem realistic?
I think it's a setback. I mean, not even in terms of like clinically, but even just for what we do, because it really slows us down. And I think like if you were to move that into the clinical space, I mean, you would have to have someone who knows how to take it apart and clean it and put it back together. It's a huge problem, I think.
But in this high throughput situation, which I guess you probably need to tell us more about that, but you're telling me, is the LC, like, is your LC situation all right? Like, it's really just like you're dirtying up the quad, but like the LC isn't on fire as you're doing this? Because I always feel like that's going to break first in my lab.
I think I got really lucky while I was acquiring a lot of my data, and the LC did not catch on fire or do anything crazy. But I think that's a very rare thing to have happen, that like all my problems are on the mass spec side.
Yeah. And so high throughput, because Ben asked like how often you're doing it. I mean, that's part of this too, right? You're saying high throughput. Can you elaborate on kind of where you're at with like what is high throughput for you?
Yeah. So we got a biomech liquid handler. So I think our lab recently is up to doing like 50 batches of TMT Pro amount of samples. So like, I mean, literally hundreds of samples. And then our bottleneck really is instrument time, because with plasma, we fractionate extensively offline and then run pretty long gradients online. So, I mean, like when I was running my samples, it took about a week to analyze one batch. And so then, I mean, I had, I think it was 11 TMT Pro batches. So, you know, it was months to acquire this data. And I think that was a total of like 166 samples.
Wow.
Well, so I haven't done this in a while. And okay, maybe it's, I don't want to date myself, but where do you get, like Ben said, 400 proteins with all this fractionation and stuff? Right? What kind of numbers do you get?
Yeah. Today? So when I looked at like every protein that was identified across my batch, or not across my batches, but like just anything that was identified in at least one batch, I was getting really like 2,500 proteins, but nice. I had a lot of, you know, once I filtered out missing values and things that weren't in our QC samples, then I was down to maybe like 1,600 proteins. And then, you know, not all of those proteins were present in every batch.
Got it. Yeah.
To me, that feels pretty good. Like I have some issues with, again, blood. It's fun because like it's almost in my opinion, and you maybe want to go off on this too, is when I see these like really big numbers, like even above 3,000, I'm like, I think you're just exploding other cells. Like I don't necessarily think this is serum. I think you've just like exploded erythrocytes or whatever else. And then it's always, to me, like beyond that top, I think 1600, 1400, okay, that's the secretome. But beyond that, I start wondering, what is it actually that you're maybe getting at? Do you kind of see that? Because you're at a ceiling, like you're obviously at this kind of this cutting edge part. Like, how do you see serum like getting deeper?
And I think part of it too probably depends on how you do your database searching, because like when I do mine, I include isoforms and stuff like that. And so then that's all counting toward like the total number of proteins that I'm reporting.
And do you, are you doing a lot of PTM searches as well?
We're not actually.
Because when I just look in other people's plasma stuff, because I haven't done it all the time, and I look at the, like if they keep the low mass fragment spectra, it just looks like every other spectra has like an oxonium ion from a glycan, right? So, but I haven't looked in a while.
Yeah,
because I think.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, because I think like 10 years ago, heavy fractionation, Orbitrap Velus, like 800 proteins was a really, really good day for us. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I would say I don't know really like where we go next with plasma and serum in terms of like number of IDs. I feel like it would in a lot of ways almost be more helpful to start just looking at not more like targeted work, but instead of pushing like the depth of proteome coverage, looking more at like what actually is clinically relevant.
Yeah. And maybe that's a good transition. I know we, because I wanted to know like these technical details, but you know, you mentioned, you started off with this really important thing, and I actually want to kind of hear more on that. So you're looking at sepsis response between, and there's like these racial differences. I mean, like, can you give us a taste of that? Like what's some big, like what change, I don't even know, like what changes in sepsis? What are those signals? And then, yeah, just go.
Yeah. So basically my cohort has survivors and non-survivors. So basically people came into the emergency room, they were diagnosed with sepsis, blood was drawn, and then we defined a survivor or non-survivor as whatever their status was 90 days after they showed up to the hospital. And so really like there's been a lot of studies done on that kind of question before, but they've really only studied non-Hispanic white patients. And that's despite the fact that hospital data shows there's, disparities in mortality between patients of different backgrounds, and socioeconomic factors account for a lot of that, but not entirely. So we were really curious, you know, if there was something on like the molecular, you know, proteomic level that could help explain that. So it was really interesting because one of our key findings was that there are actually, I believe it was 19 proteins that were changing the same way in survivors of both non-Hispanic white and African-American or Black racial backgrounds. And those proteins were largely related to like liver cell activation and like triggering the immune response, which really made sense because that kind of suggested that survivors had a lower like pro-inflammatory and response to their infection and to sepsis. But then on the other hand, we also noticed that there were some immune pathways and proteins really only like significantly enriched in one racial group or another. So that, you know, kind of suggests that there perhaps are some race specific changes going on.
And you're writing that this is kind of the, why aren't you going to US HUPO? It's because you're actually, you were told, write your dissertation. So you're actively like putting this all together right now, right?
Yeah. So one paper came out last year, Molecular Omics. I think it was in the US HUPO special issue from last year. And that was our work from part of the cohort on patients who had abdominal infections as their infection source that developed into sepsis. And so now we're working on a manuscript that's basically the same idea, but with patients who had UTIs or urinary tract infections.
So can you deposit this data in terms of, you know, you take that and put it in Massive and it's no problem or Pride?
Yeah, it's on Pride. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes I reach out to people that I see their papers and I just reach out to see, you know, why their data isn't on Massive, and they'll say, you know, patient confidentiality things. And I know the rules are different from place to place, but that's great that you can still use, that you can make your data available.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. It's hard for me, as we're talking about it and, it, you know, with certain diseases or things like that, like, I don't know why, like, as you're talking about sepsis from these, like, other infections, I don't know why, but it's not making me nervous, but it's definitely making me, I'm like, oh, because, like, it's the thing that, like, it happens, and it's, mm-hmm. and it's not necessarily rare, and you just don't hear about it a lot, but I know it happens, right? Like, oh, I've got this little thing, and then I died. right? I mean, it's a pretty, like, it happens.
Sepsis, I think, 100% mortality. Like, I just assume based on that. So I'm glad that you have a surviving cohort to see.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things we didn't look at, but what I've read is, you know, even if you survive sepsis, a lot of sepsis survivors end up being readmitted later on or suffer, like, PTSD from it. It's such a, you know, whole body problem.
Yeah. But that said, and I mean, so you're at Vanderbilt and we've kind of touched on this with some other people. I mean, do you find that to be kind of an extra motivation factor, right? Like you're actively looking for markers to save lives, right? Like that's got to provide some motivation, right?
Oh, it definitely does. And you know, for me, it's really important that my work does kind of have that clinical importance to it. So it's a huge motivating factor to try to see, like, you know, why does this disparity exist? How can we fill in the gaps of the knowledge around it? And, you know, like in discovering that some of those proteins were changing in the same way, like, could these be biomarkers down the road for all patients, not just a certain group of patients?
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. I mean, I think that motivation is really helpful, which kind of gets, and we're going to kind of pivot away from that, but you know, where do you see, I guess, so normally at this point we ask people like, how did you get where you are? And if you want to go into that, that's awesome. Like, why are you doing this? But I think also as you talk, I really would like you to talk about where you think you're kind of going, even though that's really hard to say. But so yeah, you can tell like, how did you get there? But but please talk about where you think you're going, because I think it's really exciting.
Yeah. So I actually just submitted a application for a postdoc program at Stanford yesterday. So I'm looking at postdoc positions, and I really want to stay in proteomics, but I think in my postdoc really, you know, continue to work on these like clinically relevant questions and really drive that forward. Where I really want to end up is being like tenure track faculty at like a liberal arts institution, because I went to a small liberal arts institution for undergrad. I went to Gannon University in Erie, and I loved the environment. I loved how it was very much like a family, and I would really love to, you know, find a way to still do this research, but also combine teaching and mentoring with it.
Well, that's
great, because, you know, small schools need more talent pumped into them. Especially on the research side. And I think you start to see a lot of even the liberal arts schools where they're starting to increase their percentage of research these days. And so now that's great.
Yeah, I remember I went to a little school briefly in Maryland, and we had someone that she ended up going to Vandy after, but it was, you know, to have that caliber of person on staff is like, it's huge, right? Because that's what, again, like, I don't think I was anybody in undergrad, probably wasn't anyone in grad school, but like having those people was, you know, easy. That's what pushed me in certain directions. Like, okay, sure. Like analytical biochemistry, that's viable, probably because I had these role models and I saw them and they talked to me.
Oh, definitely. So. And, you know, kind of going back to like the origin story. I mean, I went to grad school because I had a wonderful female professor sit me down and be like, you should go to grad school. Like, you would do really well in grad school. And I don't think that I saw that as like a path until I heard, you know, someone who looked like me and someone who I respected a lot tell me to do that.
And that's exactly what it takes. Well, great.
And you have such, and I know we're not like gushing about like your advisor right now, but I adore her. Like, you know, Renee Robinson, right? Yeah, she's just, you know, she's something. And so again, like, I love that idea of, you know, you propagate it, right? And we've seen that too. Other people that we've had on the show, right? Jenny Van Eyck, Yingyi, you know, they've all kind of had that mentality, and you see it. They are changing, right? They're changing the field. Mm-hmm. So I think that's awesome to hear. Now, do you have anything, not to pry, but like going back, like Did you like meet like some famous scientist and you're like, I'm going to do that? Or is it really just like you're an undergrad and this person's like, you should go to grad school. You'd be awesome.
Yeah, I think it was more so that where I figured out that I really liked biochem and, you know, I knew I wanted to do, you know, something that was important and meaningful, because that was something I had struggled with as a chem major, was like, well, how is this actually like making a difference? And I was kind of tossing around like, well, what do I do after I graduate? And, you know, she talked to me and helped me go get into an REU. And I really loved that. And then I applied to Vanderbilt and kind of just stumbled along Dr. Robinson's lab. And then I was like, oh, this is really cool. I think I could do this. Like, this is really awesome.
Well, you know, that kind of puts you in rare air anyway, because the number of people in the world who've ever said the words, I really liked biochem, is such a small number. Like, okay, you should go to grad school because you're going to have trouble finding anybody else who's going to say that again.
But that idea of like impact, I think that was, I actually circled around, like I was in biochem and then I just had this like crisis of faith. I was like, what am I doing? Am I just like making drugs like for pharmaceutical companies? And then I quit and like became a soil scientist. And then like I looped back into it and I was like, okay, like I see the clinical relevance. I see like helping people or animals. But yeah, I think that's a tough one when you're starting out, and to have that, be able to see the vision. Again, like I credit to you for seeing that, and then even getting a problem like this, right? I mean, doing this for grad school is, you know, you're out of the gates, like you're doing something big. Yeah. That's huge. So
time for another pivot. I think I know the answer to this because you're obviously in the lab all of the time. But if a time does arise that you're not in the lab, what do you do when you're not in the lab?
I am a Steelers fan, so it's been kind of, you know, growing pains over a year, but I love watching the Steelers. I have a little hamster named Princess Leia.
No.
So, you know, I cater to her needs. But I spend a lot of time flying back to Pennsylvania to see my family. I recently got engaged, so I love spending time with my fiance and his family as well. And I also like crafting a lot. And that includes just going to Michael's and like walking up and down the aisles, finding new craft projects.
Like
both crafting and buying craft supplies.
Are we talking like bedazzling or like cross stitch, or just like what's like your favorite crafting situation?
I like cross stitching. I recently for Christmas got like a learn to crochet kit. So that's been the newest like thing I'm on.
I only ask because my daughter, like, she really likes that sort of stuff. And I am not crafty. Like, that's it with my kids. I can tell you I'm as good as like a 5-year-old. And so she's way past me. And so I'm always thinking, so actually I said bedazzle because like, she's not going to listen, but she's getting that for her birthday because I think she's just going to like bedazzle stuff. But there's so much cool stuff like in a Michaels, right? And okay, so cross stitch, that's pretty cool. Or crochet. Yeah. And congrats, today is at, well, not about me. It's my anniversary. Too much information for everyone there, but it's a fun road. So good luck.
Thanks.
You've got Princess Leia. You're in Vanderbilt. I know there's a lot going on. I mean, obviously it's a music town. A lot of incredible bluegrass, but I don't know if like that's your, have you, it, I'm going to ask a Nashville thing. Yeah. What's your favorite thing that may not even be like stereotypical Nashville, but like, this is your favorite thing to do?
So I think it is stereotypical Nashville. And this is something that I think it really was lost during the pandemic. But so my first week, or maybe like my second week at Vanderbilt, Dan and Shay had their first number one hit. And so they like blocked off a parking lot in Nashville and you could just like literally go for free and go to their concert. And Nick Jonas made an appearance. And so that was like, wow, like I moved to a fun place.
Yeah.
And then last summer, once things started opening back up, Luke Combs did kind of a similar thing where you could just go stand in a parking lot for like $20 and hear him perform all of his songs like acoustic with the songwriters. And then me and my friend found him after the concert and got his autograph and got to talk to him. So those like kind of just all of a sudden, like go to a parking lot and hear some really big names is really fun to do in Nashville.
And I feel like, and again, I'm assuming the people you just mentioned are country music.
Yes.
Okay. Sorry. but I know, you know, just so I know I'm more of like on the bluegrass side of things, but I know, you know, when you watch like CMA, they're legit musicians. Like these aren't, you know, like some pop stars like play some music. Like most of them are legit. Like you give them a guitar or a piano, they can do it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you get to see all that firsthand. Like you said, like he's just like doing some acoustic sets.
Yeah.
Rocking it out. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nashville is definitely, I think about some things that I did. I lived there one summer and like I went to the Ryman and saw this group of like seven guys. And at the time I didn't appreciate that it was this like moment in time. Like half of them have now passed on. They were legends and I was just there. So no, that's super cool.
Yeah.
I don't know how the country music scene is out in Stanford though. So just saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that department. But the weather would be a little better.
Yeah, that's true.
Is there any, I mean, wait, so hold on. Because only we don't have too many people that are actually in grad school or finishing up. I mean, since we do have like that younger audience, I hope, I don't know. Is there, now that you're towards the end, is there any kind of like words of wisdom that you do give to people? Like, hey, you're starting out, here's some stuff to do.
This might sound kind of dark, but honestly, like I tell people, like start going to therapy and really.
No, we actually got this from another set of guests. Keep going. I completely agree. Keep going.
But I think, especially having lived through grad school during the pandemic, I don't think I would still be in grad school if I hadn't like made that investment in going to therapy. And, you know, I mean, like Dr. Robinson is great, but, you know, even when you have a great situation, grad school is hard. And I just think it would have been a lot easier if I had just started out working through those things. So.
Yeah, I'm absolutely supportive of that idea. I think that's a great idea.
And we talk a lot about like that self-care and you know, we're all like me and Ben, we're like 100 years old. I joke. But you know, I think things were hard for it, like 20 years ago, but I do think the modern age is probably not helping. And society. So it's like you take an already hard situation and then you're like, let's make this harder. Like, let's make this really like psychologically traumatizing. I'm laughing, but that's probably great advice. So yeah.
Wow. Well, where are we at?
Oh wait, Chicago. I'm still gonna ask Chicago. I don't care if we're not good. Have you ever been to Chicago?
I have been to Chicago twice, actually.
See? Okay. We're going to be there, the conference that your boss will be at. It's like, it's going to be March, you know, that first week of March. It's going to be cold. We're at the Drake. Do you have any, like, advice, tips and tricks? You should definitely go to this place. Don't go to this place.
I really like Navy Pier. They have a big Ferris wheel where you can, I mean, you can go up and like see kind of the skyscrapers and whatnot, but the like view of the lake is really pretty. I also love the field museum, like the natural history museum, because I swear you could spend like days in there just going through all of their exhibits. And I've also done like one of like the river cruises where you like can sail down the Michigan River.
We had
and they have like different themes. Like one of the ones was like an architecture one. I've also done a
it's exactly like a what was recommended.
I think the other one I did was like Chicago Gangsters or something like that. So yeah, so there's like lots of cool sites to see. And just I think it's what's the pizza place? The deep dish pizza place.
People have said it. Someone was like, get takeout to the Drake.
I know they have a restaurant at Navy Pier. I forget what it's called, but that's kind of a must try.
Okay. These were all great things. And we've definitely had people on the show who have not been to Chicago. Mm-hmm. And it's great that, I'm sorry that you won't be there, but it's great that you had maybe more advice than anybody else we've asked.
It's so weird that you even said the river cruise. Our last person actually said that. And we're like, really? Yeah, so that's two votes on a river cruise.
I mean, I don't know what it'll be like in March, though.
Yeah.
Like cold. Sleds. I feel like you have sled dogs, right? At that point, because it's frozen and like you're on the tundra.
Yeah, and I guess you won't be there. I think they dye the river green for St. Patrick's Day. But I don't think you have to pose over.
It'll be a week early.
Yeah.
Oh.
Bummer.
But well, take a winter coat.
Oh yeah.
I even got shoes. I got special shoes that are because I live in Charleston, so like I have flip-flops at this point and like nothing. So I'm actually, I have shoes that will not make my feet cold.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta invest in those like duck boots.
Yeah.
I can picture that.
It reminds me, my fiance is from Mississippi. So when we were in Pennsylvania over the like -10 cold spell over Christmas, I was like, I mean, it's cold, but like you just put layers on and, you know, your duck boots and everything and you can survive. And he was not anywhere near that point.
No, we're not acclimatized to that. It's too cold. That's why we don't live there. No, it's been a running joke how cold it is in Chicago. And you're from another cold place. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Cool. I mean, no, that's, Ben, I think we touched on everything.
Yeah.
Regardless of US HUPO or not.
Yeah. So, Katie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. This is fun. It's like something different to do and be a part of.
Absolutely. No, we appreciate having you on. So real fast, some credits, any views expressed are solely ours. A big thank you to US HUPO for sponsoring this series. There's a song that you will hear, that is by Johannes. Kaylee Kirkwood did our artwork. Again, wherever you get your podcast, please subscribe, like, stars, thumbs, leave a review. The reviews keep on coming and they're hilarious. So please do a review for us. And again, thank you. Thank you for coming on. Appreciate it.
Thank you.